Hello and welcome to the Providence College Podcast. I'm your host, Liz Kay, and I'm joined by producer Chris Judge of the class of 2005. Here at the Providence College Podcast, we bring you interesting stories from the Fryer family. This week, we're speaking with Dr. Deborah Levine of the Department of Health Policy and Management. Dr. Levine is a medical historian who earned a doctorate in the history of science at Harvard University. We're talking to her today about what we can learn from the history of pandemics. Dr. Levine, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, there's been a lot of concern, you know, as we answer about all the unanswered questions regarding the coronavirus that we're currently in. And some of those questions have been about the costs that will be in play. You wrote a great op-ed for the Washington Post about how this played out in the era of polio. Can you tell us about how Jonas Salk responded to questions about patenting the polio vaccine?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, these moments of uncertainty, particularly with regards to public health and our healthcare system, really throw into sharp relief just how many sort of holes in our safety net there really are. And there are things that for those of us who have the privilege of good health insurance and good access to care, it's easy to forget about in our regular day to day. But in these moments, it's certainly in the forefront of a lot of people's minds. One of the things that comes to mind is the fact that so many private and public laboratories right now are working on better testing for the COVID-19, the novel coronavirus. They are working on developing therapeutics, and they're working on hopefully developing a vaccine. There are many fantastic, really brilliant researchers around the country and around the world working on these things. And one of the first testimony when Congress was talking to our Secretary of Health and Human Services, Secretary Azar, they said, well, will you promise that these interventions will be either free or accessible to all Americans? And Secretary Azar said, I can't promise that because we need to have private industry involved. And if we want private industry to innovate, then we need to promise the possibility of big profits. And that really struck me because while profits can definitely be a driver of innovation, one of the things I know from my health policy experience, from teaching in health policy and management, from the study of the history of science and medicine, one of the things that I know is that profit is not the only driver of innovation. And the most dramatic example I can think of from American history is the example of Jonas Salk and the polio vaccine. Jonas Salk was part of a team that was funded by private funders, nonprofit funders as well. The organization that's now the March of Dimes was involved with raising millions of dollars to help develop, to help several scientists work to try to develop an effective vaccine. And there was public money involved. And when Salk and his research team, who are at the University of Pittsburgh, developed finally a successful and safe vaccine, there was a lot of talk about how could they profit, would they be patenting the vaccine. And though in the early days, his team considered those complexities, ultimately they came down and said, this is a vaccine that belongs to the people. Could you patent the sun? Is the famous line that he said with Edward R. Murrow on the news. And part of why he was saying that was because there was so much public funding and involvement and really the necessary public trust of a widespread vaccine effort like this. And so he and his team determined that if they were going to really compel if they were willing to really, if they were going to get people excited to participate in the trials leading up to the vaccine and also just to vaccinate their own children, it needed to be something that was, in this case, free to everyone who was eligible. And that was for two reasons, right? First, it kind of needed to be free because it already belonged to the people. That was public money that made the research possible. It was 2 million American school children whose parents were willing to enroll them in a huge randomized clinical trial. These kids were called the polio pioneers, and there were experimental groups and and there were control groups. But also in the like of in the case of vaccines, you know, if everyone doesn't get it, or if not enough people get it, then they don't work, right? The immunity, they don't, if you don't get to a point in the population, and it's different for different diseases, but there are these kind of concepts of herd immunity at work. So that's the example that I thought of about how here's a case where profits were not what was driving innovation. It was a concern for the public health. It was a concern for trust in science. And, you know, in the case of polio specifically, polio was a disease that people had really seen the results of. So I was lucky enough to grow up in a post-polio vaccine era, but my grandmother wasn't, and she was always told to avoid swimming pools in the summertime. And in the 1950s, outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, when my mom's elementary school was picked as one of the polio pioneers, my grandmother enrolled both her daughters, my mom and my aunt, in the study. So this is an example of a family that was willing to take on some risk because they had seen the devastation of polio with their own eyes, and they wanted to bring a stop to it.
I think you had also mentioned that there are other examples, even in more recent history, of ways that cost controls or other limits still didn't prevent big industry from developing new medical innovations.
That's right. There are actually a lot of examples of things other than profits being drivers of innovation. This is not to say that, you know, that we are not and that we should not ever be driven by the ideas of profits, for sure. But for example, if you look at the Japanese healthcare system today, and this is the example I used in the article, Japan has strong governmental price controls. They don't have a fully public system. They are not an example, I would say they are not an example of socialized medicine. They have private doctors, private hospitals, and they have private insurers too. But those insurers are regulated very differently than our insurers are regulated. And part of that has to do with prices. So Japan is famous for having one common price book across the country. And so that means that, you know, a night in a hospital in Tokyo costs the same as a night in a hospital in a remote area, and so forth. And that price is negotiated between the providers and the government and the payers. I think every year they release a new price book. A few years ago, the Japanese government decided they were paying too much for scans, for MRIs, for CT scans, for things like that. And they radically lowered the price that they would be paying providers for every scan. Now, here in the United States, our ideology says, oh, that must hinder innovation if you're going to lower the prices. But the Japanese company, particularly Toshiba, it developed a lower cost MRI scanner. And so it was really the constrictions on price that drove the innovation in that case. And that lower cost, high quality MRI machine that Japanese tech companies developed is now sold all over the world and used globally as a lower cost MRI option. And the response to my article has been really interesting. A friend of mine wrote and said, this actually reminds me of my time in architecture school, because in architecture school, you're taught, you know, you're the most creative when you're under constraints. When you give architects no limits and say, build whatever you want, the results are often not as creative, not as exciting as when you say, oh, I have a small we're constrained by either budget or space or something like that. And that got me thinking about how we teach, you know, architects and artists and musicians about creativity, and the ways that that might, you know, that might sort of translate to some of these other kinds of arguments.
I mean, poets deal with it all the time with iambic pentameter or haiku, right?
Exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah.
They can create beautiful works with only so many syllables. So I think the other pandemic that most people are most familiar with is Spanish flu. What would you say are lessons that governments and medical providers learned from the history of Spanish flu and how it spread across the planet?
You know, just about 100 years ago, right after the end of World War I, there was a huge pandemic. It was a bad flu year. It became known as the Spanish flu. Interestingly, it became known as the Spanish flu not because it originated in Spain, but because Spain was one of the only countries where the press was allowed to report on the flu. Other countries had very restrictive press because they didn't want to be associated, I guess, with cases of the flu.
Including the United States, is that correct? That the United States didn't report on the Spanish flu?
Yeah, absolutely. So in all, there are things that are very different about our healthcare system today than there were 100 years ago, thank goodness. And there are things that are very different medically. So for example, today with a novel coronavirus that we're suffering with right now, we have therapeutic steroids that can support your own immune system, right? And help you get through it, through a thing. We have ventilators in hospitals that can support your breathing over the course of the illness. We have antibiotics that can, if you have secondary bacterial infection, that can help you process it. None of those things existed yet in the Spanish, in the 1918 flu pandemic.
Because I think some of the deaths from the Spanish flu were because of concomitant pneumonia infections, right? I mean, there were people.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, that's what often causes flu deaths every year. So, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that the 1918 flu was a terrible pandemic year. And there's so many things to learn about in terms of managing epidemics and public health from that example. But flu continues to be a disease that, recurs every year in different ways, in different strengths, and kills a lot of people every year too, particularly vulnerable people from a lot of those secondary bacterial infections. So we have many things in place today. This is not 1918. And thank goodness for that. That said, the Spanish flu gives us a lot of examples where cities that acted quickly to enact social distancing, cities that canceled events that were big crowds, had a better time managing the flow in their healthcare, in their hospital systems, than others. And the most famous example of that is the Liberty Loan Parade in every summer in Philadelphia. And there were parades of this sort, you know, all over the country. In St. Louis, they canceled their parades. They said, we're going to, you know, act quickly and suspend public gatherings. In Philadelphia, they said, no, you know, it's too important economically. This is too much of a social event for everyone. We're not going to cancel it. And within a few days, dramatically, within a few days after that big parade in Philadelphia, the hospital beds were just totally tapped. People got sick. That was a site of communicating the illness. And it really overflowed the capacity of the healthcare system in that city. And Philadelphia suffered terrible losses from the Spanish flu. St. Louis, which canceled, you know, which at the time had a similar, you know, similar demographic, similar population to Philadelphia, because they enacted that social distancing, because they canceled these big events, and sort of took the decision out of the hands of individuals of whether or not they wanted to practice some social distancing or physical distancing, really, they were able to far less losses and sort of support the healthcare system through that just devastating summer.
When we hear today about New York City canceling its St. Patrick's Day parade, this seems right in line with.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Boston canceled. I think Boston was one of the first cities to cancel their St. Patrick's Day parade. And I was thinking about Providence College and our students and how many of them go up to Boston for that event. And I am so grateful that there are smart public health officials and physicians and administrators and other people who are making, you know, politicians who are making these decisions. And from my vantage point as a historian, I can't help but marvel, you know, just how still at the mercy we humans are from novel viruses and illnesses, all of those kinds of things. I think that one of the things I've been reflecting on in the last few days, looking at the cancellation of events, for example, is that I don't think my generation has ever been asked, my generation of Americans has ever been asked to really change their plans or change their workday due to communicable illness. And that actually, we're in this moment that feels really new and strange, but it's actually, I think, a feeling that would be really familiar. To our grandparents and great grandparents and great great grandparents who would have been just accustomed to adjusting their lives for long periods of time due to this. So, in some ways, it's the success of our medical system and sort of the optimism of American life, where you think, oh, everything's always getting better. I think there's a lot of us who feel that way. That makes this feel strange, but actually, it's a very common human experience. We may be the strange ones who've never gone through this before.
That's really a profound way of thinking about it. Because if you said your grandparents' generation, if your mother was avoiding swimming pools, in elementary school, but now, we've never had that, it's not comparable to after September 11th when we were asked to go out and support the economy by buying things and being good consumers.
I've talked, I was the September, it's so September 11, 2001 was my first day of graduate school. And so all my orientation events were canceled, but I wasn't teaching yet then. But I have talked to some colleagues who taught around September 11th who have compared this moment to that one, where we sort of weren't sure what was going to come next. And we were trying to figure out ways from a higher ed perspective, right, of providing for our students' needs, continuing their education, but also operating in a way that keeps them safe. Some of the Boston-based schools right after the marathon bombings went online for a brief period of time. Harvard took its courses online for a few days. And that is a that is one of the templates that I think one of the analogs from more recent history that can apply. But I think we need to operate in such a way. Obviously, we need to balance the needs of the economy and the needs of our society with this public health epidemic. So that's something that we need to keep in mind. But what I'm advocating for, and what I learned from history, and what I really believe from my expertise as a historian, is that we need to be keeping the most vulnerable people at the center of our decisions. You don't know, the language that's evolving around this novel coronavirus suggests that, oh, this is really only a problem if you're old or if you're sick, and for the rest of us, like a bad cold. And I think there's a lot of problems with that language, even if that turns out to be true. What kind of message does that send to people who are older, who are disabled, who do have a history of cancer or smoking? I think a lot about our students. Here in health policy management, health comes up a lot in classes, and students have told me that they're type 1 diabetic or have asthma or other things that make them more vulnerable. So I think we should be making our policies with those people in mind. Really putting those folks at the center of our policies for containment, for the prevention of the spread of the disease. And I also think that, I mean, here at Providence College, it really ties into our mission, right? We're only as strong as the way that we protect our most vulnerable is basically right there in the mission. And I also think we need to remember that we don't know, and this was very true in the case of the polio vaccine, and very true in the case of certainly in the spread of the Spanish flu after World War I, where the United States was recovering from a world war. There were return, there were all kinds of social upheavals. There were new methods of communication. There was all kinds of uncertainty in the society as it was, and then they added in this illness. And so I'm really trying to remember those moments of uncertainty and the ways in which sometimes in those moments of uncertainty, we forget to take care of the people who are the most vulnerable, sort of forget to, can, as a society, we sometimes forget that, you know, you don't know which of your coworkers are taking care of their 90-year-old father-in-law. You don't know which of your students are managing conditions. And so really to just be as flexible and kind, and really thinking about that as possible. And then I guess I would also say finally, you know, another thing about the Spanish flu that persisted was a real xenophobia and racism against, you know, because it was called the Spanish flu for a while, it was called the German flu for a while, they had all kinds of names. And in each of those moments, people from those countries or with that heritage in their backgrounds or people who spoke those languages were really viewed with suspicion in the United States and kept out of public spaces in ways that were, first of all, not coherent with the science, right? The virus doesn't care. And also in ways that were really racist and problematic. And certainly one of the things I think people will study years from now about the moment that we are in is that exact aspect, and how people from East Asian backgrounds, especially Chinese, but all across, have been treated in the United States in the wake of the coverage of the media coverage of this pandemic.
I think it's interesting, you know, just as we're being asked to exercise social distancing, it kind of, at the same time, we're emphasizing our role as a society. You know, it's that contagion, even healthy individuals who hopefully will only have mild experience with this coronavirus, if they experience it at all, still have a role in whether or not people who are vulnerable will experience it. You know, it's the same idea. You know, we all need to get flu vaccine, even if in regular years, even if we are not in danger of dying from it, at grave danger, because of that concept of herd immunity. And so the practices of hand washing and social distancing that we're all being asked to exercise are really to help protect others, even when we're not in direct contact with them, even if you're not meeting, you know, regularly with elderly people, if you don't visit people in nursing homes or everything else. It's all, we all have this responsibility as part of being part of society, even when we're not seeing people regularly. Yeah,
that's right. That's absolutely right. And one of the reasons why I'm trying to use the term physical distancing rather than social distancing, because I do worry about the effects of isolation on people. And maybe here's where I get a little optimistic about the technologies of 2020, particularly, compared to the technologies of 1918 or 1953. And that's that we have, it's not the same as face-to-face or physical contact, but we have the ability to check in on people in our lives via technology. And we can help each other through these kinds of things. And we can make sure that people don't feel socially isolated, even though they're not, at the St. Patrick's Day parade or that kind of thing as well. So I think by thinking about it as physical distancing, but really there's a social responsibility to check in on the people you care about, check in on your neighbors, check in on, you know, in my case, my students, is really, that is a serious responsibility we have.
Well, Dr. Levine, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you taking the time. Subscribe to the Providence College podcast in all the usual places, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. If you like what you hear, please review and share with others. Thanks for listening, and go Friars.